You are listening to Radio Maria Canada, a Catholic voice wherever you are. We now present Ask the Lawyer, hosted by Joe Martinello.
Thank you, Nick. It's Joe Martinello in the Radio Maria studios in Toronto, Ontario, Canada, presenting our Ask the Lawyer program, as we do on the last Saturday morning of every month. We hope that all our listeners throughout Canada and perhaps even those throughout the world do perhaps tune in on the website to listen to us. We'll enjoy our programs, which are always of a legal nature. And I just wanted to remind people, if they have any questions or comments about any of the themes that we discuss from month to month on the English language broadcast, they're encouraged to call area code 416, and the phone number is 245-1534, area code 416, that's in Toronto, 245-1534. Any calls or questions are greatly appreciated, and they always lead to a greater learning, understanding, and dialogue, which is so important. I'm going to do a couple programs. We've done a lot of them on immigration and citizenship, which people found interesting, but I know some people have asked us to try to maybe vary some of the content that we're coming across, and actually going back to some of the comments that we did quite a few months ago with some of our guest hosts in English, and relating specifically to powers of attorney, wills, and estate planning. And so we're going to go back, because it seems like next to immigration citizenship law, it seems like this theme is what they call one of the hot button items people are always interested in. I guess it's because the old saying is that the one thing you can't escape is death and taxes. Of course, on Roman Catholic Radio, we have a triumvirate. It's death, taxes, and the resurrection of the body. So I guess that's our holy trinity for today. We're going to talk a little bit about these aspects, and I wanted to actually point out a couple of very interesting cases that relate to it, that have been in the newspapers a lot, and I think a lot of our listeners will should know maybe perhaps some of the background, and it's amazing how little we know. The one case that was decided in January concerned the Mount Pleasant group of cemeteries, and it's amazing how a lot of people are not aware that on our passing away, what occurs, it doesn't occur. Maybe it's we don't like to dress our mind to it, but the situation of how cemeteries are held here in Canada, which if you've listened to our broadcasts, are a matter of property rights, are fairly similar across Canada, except for Quebec, which maintains the European jurisdiction. And those of us who may be from a European jurisdiction very often are surprised to learn that very often, if someone is buried here in Ontario, it is quote-unquote forever. In other words, it's not like it is in Europe, where maybe you, wherever you are buried and pass away, it's like a short-term lease, maybe 20 to 40 years, depending on the country, and then your remains are disposed of in some other manner, which is always a bit disturbing for people today, because we all live longer. So if any of us have ever gone back to cemeteries, for example, as I have in Europe, and you remember seeing your great-grandfather buried somewhere, and then you come back one year and you say, what happened? There's a different name there. That's what it is. So the cemeteries in, for example, in places like Italy are actually run by largely by municipalities. And they are run that way also because land traditionally has been so short in supply with the great populations that came from Europe, there wasn't what we could call the luxury of actually allocating land to a family for a long, long period of time, hundreds of years or whatever, unless it was inside of a church, a chapel, or a private cemetery grounds. In Ontario, it is very different. From the earliest days of the province, there have been both religious cemeteries and also public ones. And in that context, those of us who live in Toronto, of course, know about Mount Pleasant because they're a very famous group. And there was a case in January that was decided, and I think it's important for people to understand the importance of this case as it goes through forward into the courts and just an understanding of what happens from a legal perspective. So the Mount Pleasant Cemetery that we know here in Toronto is one of 10 cemeteries owned by the Mount Pleasant Group of Cemeteries. And people often wonder what exactly are these cemeteries? Who owns them? Are they like businesses that are run and so on? They are to some extent, but actually not really. So in January, there was a case because a group of citizens went to court to argue that cemeteries were actually public land. And this is important. There were a group of people who started a battle against the trustees of the land of the Mount Pleasant Group of Cemeteries. So I think some of you have heard in some of our broadcasts talk about the question of a trustee. A trustee is someone who acts usually in the interest of someone else, a beneficiary, or in the interest of the public. And in this case was decided, it was actually decided by a judge whose other case I'm going to discuss a little bit later, Mr. Justice Dunphy, who's had some very interesting cases and analysis and decisions. And the case that I'm going to mention to you right now is actually going to be under appeal, and we'll see what happens. And I'll compare that with another case in the estates area that I think you may also find interesting. So what it was is about 5 years ago, the group of interested citizens brought a battle against against the Mount Pleasant Group of Cemeteries. And it's very interesting because the cemeteries that we think of in here in Ontario were established about 200 years ago in 1826 by the government of that time. And they established the cemetery as a public trust with public oversight. And what's interesting is that in those days, cemeteries were largely denominationally based. In other words, you could have a Catholic and Anglican cemetery. But the Mount Pleasant Group was land that was established as a non-denominational cemetery for rich and poor alike, which was pretty hard to find at that time. So it's about 200 years old. And the feeling was that the Mount Pleasant Group of Cemeteries had been operating more like a private corporation. And they, in fact, said that they were a commercial, privately owned cemetery overseen by a public board. And this whole question of how they were owned and operated from the very beginning became a very essential part of the case. The Mount Pleasant Group of Cemeteries originally only governed the Mount Pleasant Cemetery in Toronto, the very large cemetery lands that we all know about, but it grew to include 10 cemeteries across the Greater Toronto area and over 1,200 acres of land where approximately 600,000 people are buried. They now operate 4 crematoriums, 14 mausoleums, 5 visitation centers, and of course, they benefit from all those services. Some of us, particularly in the Catholic community, have noted that a lot of the Catholic cemeteries groups, which once again are also technically although it's run by the Catholic Church, it's seen much like a public trust. They've been offering, for example, funeral masses and even receptions and so on cemetery grounds, obviously in competition with, to some extent, with funeral homes, and also providing a certain aspect of one-stop shopping, as some people have described it to me. So a lot of these decisions are made by these trustees. Now, they're not people who are appointed for life. And I should say, because when I read the case myself, I wondered, I said, well, who are these people? Who are these trustees? And they all seem to be, you know, fairly well, people held in good standing as the trustees. And Mr. Justice Sean Dunphy said is he said that the land was a public trust and should be governed by a board consisting of members from the public. He said that the current directors and members of the Mount Unpleasant Cemetery Group were not validly appointed, and that operating funeral centers and crematoria went beyond the governing rights. So the trust was prohibited from using the land for anything other than places for burial of the dead. He also ruled that public elections would need to be held to appoint a public board. And he said that the land fell under something called the Charities Accounting Act, which means that a specific part of the government has authority governing over it, and the board has to follow a very, very strict set of rules and regulations. Now, the group that complained about the Mount Pleasant Cemetery Group, I wanted an investigation into the finances, but the judge had noted, and this is very important because sometimes we can be very cynical and think, oh, this must be people who are lining their pockets. But the judge was very careful to point out that there were no allegations to suggest that public funds had gone missing, or in fact that there had been misappropriation. So it, and from my research subsequently, it seemed that the people basically served on the board were paid what I would call not an, a reasonable, unreasonable amount to sit on the board for no more than 10 years, and they would rotate through, and one imagined that there would be a certain continuity from people who resigned and carried on or decided to stand down for election. And from everything that I've seen, and you should know that the financial statements for the group are also a matter of public record. You can actually see exactly if you go into a website to see, because their funds have to be audited and what they do and how they do it and so on. So it's quite, it's fairly transparent, as I said, notwithstanding the court application that was brought along. And I guess the key was how much public input would there be to see into these aspects of transparency and accountability. Now, as I said, this is very different from the European model, where basically people for no more than 40 years are basically rotated out and their place is then given to someone else. So it was quite a struggle. It's worked its way through the courts, and this is the initial decision. This originally arose, the whole thing arose because the Mount Pleasant Cemetery Group had actually wanted to donate 9 acres of land in an unused portion of the York Cemetery, which is in the Young Shepherd area. You're located in a ravine with a creek running through it. Actually, my father-in-law is buried there in the mausoleum, and it's an area that's quite pretty, but I guess the idea was that there was going to be a deal with the City of Toronto, the full details of which we don't have, in which the land would be donated to the city and create a public park. So here we have two public entities essentially fighting each other for the public good. One is, of course, for the proper running of the cemetery, and the other one is, of course, for the creation of parkland. And a lot of the decisions that are related to it that I have read result are an interpretation of what happened when the cemeteries were first constructed. So we can see, again, from a legal aspect, how important these decisions or these laws are, because 200 years later, they're now arguing or discussing about who gets to be elected as a director, what the lands can be used for or not, What are the rules concerning a public trust? And it's going to be very, very important, not only for the Mount Pleasant group of cemeteries, but for the Catholic cemeteries and how they were established and whether or not they can do certain things or not. So you're going to see this case, which involves death. So as we said, death taxes and maybe the resurrection of the body in terms of the Catholic cemeteries, is going to be an item that you're going to see going to the Court of Appeal. And it revolves around the interpretation of the original trust documents that were done 200 years ago for a public cemetery. So it's something to look at, but that's the context of it. And people should know that no matter what their form of burial is. And this case also made me think about another aspect of estate planning law that Mr. Justice Dunphy had decided that has gone to the Court of Appeal and, in fact, overturned his original decision. So it'll be very interesting because this judge has offered a particular interpretation of the law, and it will be important in the cemetery aspect to see how it's working or doesn't work, and, in fact, may motivate a lot of our politicians, perhaps the public, too, to be involved in how cemeteries are run and maybe the laws that are 200 years old need to be updated, modernized, and maybe some consensus reached. And the other case that Mr. Justice Dunphy had decided last year concerned the use of what we call double wills, or and what exactly is a will. And some of you may recall from our earlier broadcast that one of the common tools used, especially for business people, when they're doing the estate administration, or what we call probate, is the use of something called a double will. In other words, the government of Ontario has decided in their wisdom that if you have to come to the courts to do estate administration, what used to be called probate, whether with or without a will, you're going to pay a fee to the province of Ontario. Some people refer to it as a tax of 1.5% of the value of its assets, and in addition to legal fees and everything else, in order for you to be able to administer, in other words, to get the imprimatur, as we say, of the courts in Ontario as to the executor or the administrator's ability to manage the estates of the deceased. And what happened was that if you look at the history again of the law, this was really to give certainty so that if I was dealing with the estate of somebody, or I was an executor, for example, in the state, I could determine what needs to be done for somebody who passes away. Because once again, when we all pass away, there are things that happen, like the filing of income tax returns. Death and taxes are hand in hand. And then there's maybe properties that have to be sold, or monies that have to be distributed or paid to beneficiaries or charities and so on. And so we have a fairly established regime through our law that deals with these issues. And what Mr. Justice Dunphy, in a case called Remilne, M-I-L-N-E, was forced to decide was whether or not the situation of what we call a primary or a secondary will, was it a valid estate planning tool? And as I said, traditionally it was to give certainty to the people that you deal with that, in fact, the person who says he's the executor or administrator of the state, someone has the imprimatur of the courts in Ontario. Again, it's a property right, and therefore it's a provincial jurisdiction here in Canada. And what people also don't realize is that more and more it's becoming extremely difficult not to obtain a probate of estates. When I was a young lawyer almost 40 years ago and somebody passed away, if they owned a house, for example, we would just register the will on title, for example. And if it said the will said, I leave the house to my children in equal shares, and then we would transfer the property to the kids, and we wouldn't have to do a probate application. It wasn't necessary. But all that has changed because now most of the property is under the Land Titles Act. You cannot transfer property. by depositing, as we used to, a will under the old registry system. You see how the land registry system and ownership of land intermingles with state's law. And so you're forced essentially to in most cases, to obtain state administration in order to sell the property of a deceased. And when you do that, you have to include all the assets of the deceased in a special detailed application, and to pay Caesar his due and pay the 1.5% tax to the province of Ontario. And so the all kinds of mechanisms have occurred because to try to avoid the payment of that tax legally, because really it's not actually really a tax as such. It was supposed to be a fee. And so they said, look, if there's a way to avoid this administration but still have the will to be valid, or we can minimize the impact of these charges, this is a state administration fee, can it be done? And one of the ways of doing it was to be having multiple wills done at the same time, primary and secondary will. You might say to me, Joe, well, why would people do that, or what would be the reason behind it? And traditionally, what we used to do for secondary wills, we would create them at the same time, a primary and secondary will. And what we said was, this is the primary will of Mr. X, where he has the executor and the beneficiaries and so on. But we're going to exclude something that we have put into our exclude assets will. And, you know, and we, in the exclude asset will, we make specific reference to the primary will. And so they're done contemporaneously. And traditionally, what we used to do in the secondary will is we used to put assets into there that really don't need probate or estate administration. Things like jewelry, I'll give you an example, the furniture in the house, maybe some pieces of art, shares in a company. If you had an active business, why would you need to go to the province of Ontario to have the imprimatur if it was a family business? So this was what we traditionally used to use to be included in secondary wills in order to avoid the impact of this tax and the administrative difficulties. Because as we all know, everybody in the world is very skeptical of who has the legal authority to represent the interest of a deceased person and who represents his state. So this was one way of doing it and reducing the tax burden. Unfortunately, in my view, even though Mr. Justice Dunphy was overturned on appeal and some reasons that I'll talk about, there was this technique where actually you didn't specify at all what was in the primary will or in the secondary will. Very, very aggressive tax planning that was done by certain law firms in the city. And this case came before Mr. Justice Dunphy. And I'm going to tell you what the key issue was. And the key issue was whether or not the will is a trust. Now, what's funny is that we as lawyers in legal language, we refer to what we call inter vivos trusts. These are often called family trusts, for example, or there are situations that exist while you are alive. And they always have what we call the three certainties, you know, the certainty of intention to establish, some consideration. It used to be traditionally gold coin, the executors and beneficiaries who are noted. And so when I talked previously about the public trust and the setting up of the Mount Pleasant Cemetery groups, that's what we're talking about also. It's almost like saying a corporation that has, because corporations technically can live forever, so can trusts. And people don't realize before corporations existed, limited companies existed, the trust existed. The trust is actually an example of English law going back to the times of the Magna Carta in England in the 11 and 1200s, where this question of how land was owned, assets were held, was set up through something called a trust. It's a very rich tradition, going back to the very origins of the common law that we have adopted here in Ontario. So before corporations existed, trusts existed. And then through the years, there have been legislation dealing with trusts and so on. But we as lawyers, is called family trusts or inter vivos trusts that are used as a tax planning measure and maneuver. But we also the language that's used for wills is they were often called testamentary trusts. And so people, some clients would sometimes say to me, testamentary trust. I mean, why is that? Well, because we have the person who sets up a trust, the deceased, we have executors, and then we have beneficiaries, and they settle certain assets through this trust, and therefore the language that has been used as a testamentary trust. And so this was an issue that arose originally in the Milne case, and I can tell you what occurred, because this caused a great deal of consternation amongst estate planners in Ontario, not just lawyers, but also accountants and consultants who assist people in the planning of their estate matters. So what had happened was that Mr. and Mrs. Milne had actually died on the same day. And each of them had, in this case, had died testate. In other words, they had a will, and they had executed mere primary and secondary wills. In other words, they said, this is my will, which has all these assets except what's in my secondary will, and vice versa. And each of the primary wills were submitted to the Ontario Supreme Court with applications for a certificate of appointment of a state trustee with a will limited to the assets in the will. And this would be a pretty standard procedure of those of us who practice in this. And this went before the application judge, who was Mr. Justice. And the judge looked at this thing and he said, wait a minute, he said, I'm going to deny all of these applications because the will, he said, the first thing is that the will is a trust. Now, people would say, well, what does that mean? Well, as I said to you before, we have euphemistically referred to a will as a trust. And therefore, there are three certainties that are required for a valid express trust that are applicable to wills. And so the judge said that because these three certainties weren't established, the certainty of intention, administrators and beneficiaries, and assets included, that each clause failed to identify the deceased property to which it applies. And the judge finally said that the court is inquisitorial. And what that means is has an obligation and an entitlement to inquire and question and do an inquisition into the matters of probate and to declare the will invalid. Now, the inquisitorial aspect, I should tell you, is very common in European law, not so common in North American law. So the judge in that particular case last year said it was proper for him to examine these elements at the probate stage because the probate function of the court has an inquisitorial function that it demands that it ascertain and pronounce what documents constitute the testator's last will and testament. And he concluded on the face that there were big questions of validity, and it raised issues about the certainty of what was in the wills that went to their essential validity. So the judge goes ahead and he says it must be a subject matter that's definitive, ascertainable at the time of death, as the will creates a trust. And the primary will conferred discretion on the executors to later decide which assets would be in the primary will of each testator. And he said that's not valid because it doesn't say what should or should not be included, and it should be set aside. And that should be the situation. So you can see that this was a very big issue because this had been under judicial scrutiny for judges, for lawyers for many years, and now it was being thrown upside down. It was being thrown upside down because of the situation. And this is exactly the same judge who made the decision in the Mount Pleasant group of cemeteries. So now we're going to have a little break, and I'm going to come back and talk about what the divisional court thought about about the decision of Mr. Justice Dunphy and why they thought he was not right. Thank you, Nick. Here we are back in the Radio Maria studios in Toronto, continuing with the theme that we started today relating to death taxes and what we call probate or estate administration and the use of multiple wills in particular. So this case then went to the Court of Appeal that we're talking about, Mr. Justice Dunphy's case. Why? Because there was another case decided by another judge, which was exactly contrary to what Mr. Justice Dunphy had imagined would be the law, which was a, I would call it probably a revolutionary interpretation. So it should be pointed out that the Ontario Divisional Court, and it may not be the end of the day, because in the future there may be a Court of Appeal or Supreme Court decision, but the Court of Appeal stepped back and they said, well, we've got these two conflicting cases in the lower court. One, the judge says that the use of multiple wills with the language that was used was extremely too broad, not ascertainable. And one that says basically the use of multiple wills has been confirmed as a valid estate planning tool in Ontario since 1998, and it also helps to reduce the tax that's payable under the State Administration Act and helps to avoid the delays associated with obtaining a certificate of appointment and also to preserve privacy in respect of certain assets. So what basically occurred, we had three judges who had to consider this, what we call this basket clause, to condition what was a proper interpretation or not of the case. And the court essentially said, no, the will is not a trust. And that's the bottom line, because as I said to you, we euphemistically refer to the will, or what we do in a will, as a testamentary trust. And so the judges presided their analysis, and it's going to be important to understand because, as I mentioned in the cemetery cases that we started the program, cemetery, Mount Pleasant Group cemetery cases, there's going to be a discussion at an appeal court level, really around these issues about trust and not, and what's needed. So, the Court of Appeal said, look, when somebody passes away. Now, we always tell our clients that a will is like a work in progress. It's what's valid today is valid today, and things can change over time, and therefore there can be life-changing events that need to change the will. The wills that are necessary for a younger couple are very different, very often, than an older person, and they have different focuses. So although in the essential aspects of it are different, the same in terms of how they're created. But the Court of Appeal said a testator can often execute their last will and testament several years in advance of their death. So it's not practical to have a definitive list of assets which do or do not require a certificate of appointment at the time that primary and secondary wills are executed. And to overcome this practical problem, estate planning lawyers often provide estate trustees with the power to determine whether a particular asset requires a certificate of appointment to administer the will. And these are often referred to as allocation clauses. And after a brief review of all the case law and so on, the court concluded, as I said, that the will is not a trust. And that, moreover, that even if the estate administration, it's interesting, so they were hedging their bets here, because they knew this thing could be determined or looked at by a court of appeal or by Supreme Court in the future. They said, even if Section 2.1 of the Estates Administration Act creates a trust in favor of the persons beneficially entitled to the deceased person's property by law, the trust would be created by statute, not by the will. And such a trust is a statutory trust and is not subject to the three certainties. And this is going to be important because the law of trust is a common law jurisdiction going back to the beginnings of the English common law 700-800 years ago, had these three certainties of intention, beneficiaries, and object. And so what the good judges were saying is that what we do under estates and administration in Ontario is a statutory trust, and it's not subject to the common law. And then finally, the court said they looked at the broader question of interpretation and the validity of powers of appointment and other discretion that's granted to estate trustees within a will. And they said that's a matter of a construction, not a grant of probate. And so they favored the one case that said this was quite okay. This was the Panda case from last year by Mr. Justice Penny. And therefore, they did not agree with Mr. Justice Dunphy, and that appears to be the state of the law. This provided a great sense of relief for a lot of practitioners and a lot of law firms, because they'd been advising clients set up these kinds of wills. So in my opinion, they're still quite aggressive, and the jury is not out, as we say, on the final determination of this issue. And we, as a planning tool, we prefer to be a lot more specific in order to avoid these kinds of, let's say, arguments being presented at a judicial level. So, as I said, that all of the issues that were raised were decided, and I think we're going to see in this Mount Pleasant Group of Cemeteries case, we're going to see a similar analysis. They're going to talk about, and you listeners will now know, they'll say, well, is this really a trust at common law, or is it a trust under statute? And if it's a trust under statute, do we meet all these requirements? Because remember, Mr. Justice Dunphy is also the person who decided that, and the judges will be faced with this decision. It'll be contested and will have longstanding implications, and I wouldn't be surprised in the Mount Pleasant Group of Cemeteries case, given the value of it. If you looked at the value of all those lands that the Mount Pleasant Group of Cemeteries undertakes, I forget, it's like $1 billion. It's an enormous, maybe more than $1 billion. But the financial statements that are a matter of public record allude to all these things. And so they said, once again, I think because the financial stakes are so high, the costs of having the matter litigated and so on, will dictate what exactly can properly happen with that. So it's interesting, but we can see again that they're very different points of view. So from a lawyer's perspective, those are the interesting cases that relate to the Mount Pleasant Group of Cemeteries, these cases relating to primary and secondary wills, and the whole question that I always tell people, when we're looking at something, you have to go back to the beginning and you have to go look at the history and how things were done. And these cases, you can imagine 200 years later, here we are looking at cases where private or let's say public trust type cemeteries were established 200 years ago. How are they going to be run? This will have a big impact, in my opinion, also as to all other religious ceremony cemeteries and how they're run. Because you can see the analysis that was done was that if you establish a trust and you say it's set up only to do A, B, and C, you cannot do D. And you might say, well, you know, things change, yes. But if things change, maybe the law has to change. And therefore, this is where we're going to see the discussion that way. There's also a lot of legal discussion about how cemeteries are being run, the legislation being antiquated, that it would need to be updated. And you will see that it is in this context of trust law, statute law, and how things carry on to create permanent cemeteries that we're going to see that. Now, you may say, well, we've seen in places in England or perhaps even here that cemeteries have been decommissioned. And yes, it does occur. It's a very, very complicated process. There's a great deal of respect given to those people who have passed on and, of course, who have paid a lot of money to be buried in a certain way. So this is what we're going to see in some of the cases. And that was sort of my introduction for the first of perhaps a couple of programs that we're going to talk about, because people have repressed the view, aside from the generalities, to talk very specifically about what occurs in planning techniques that we use even more commonly, which are powers of attorney for property, powers of attorney for personal care, and wills, the actual specific terms. What is it that we look at? Because as lawyers, to us, all of these things are sort of like getting up in the morning and having, you know, your juice or having breakfast. You know, it's like we live and breathe this stuff. So for us, it's normal. But of course, the whole world doesn't live and breathe this. Most of our listeners don't. It's only moments of crisis or planning that this thing, that these matters suddenly come into focus. And it was really this past month when I had a number of, I had about five or six clients who were involved in estate planning matters. And these issues came up because they look at the exact language we used and they would say, well, why do you do this language? What is the reason behind that? What if I want to be cremated or not? What if this and what if that? And I thought, it's a good idea with the idea of what we saw in the cemetery cases and the question of trust and this, less well-known estate planning technique to talk about powers of attorneys and wills. And so today I'm going to carry on talking about powers of attorney. Though the end of our next presentation next month, I'm going to dedicate more time to wills themselves and specific clauses. So powers of attorney, again, you have to go back into the history and go back to the beginning. When I was a lawyer 40 years ago, there wasn't really anything called the Powers of Attorneys Act that exists today, but they were commonly used because why? Because we have this great tradition of the English common law, exactly the same thing I mentioned before with the development of trusts. And the law in those days developed on a very piecemeal, judge-made decision, case-by-case basis, and encompassed what we call the common law. And this is not statute law. Statute law is more of traditionally a European invention that largely arose in Europe, especially at the time of Napoleon, because they always referred to the law in Europe as the Napoleonic Code. So they tried to codify the law. It's not the only one. The Romans had done it also. There was a Roman law. There was the Hammurabi Code in the Mideast thousands of years ago. So there were tendencies to try to codify law. But in England, there was a lot of it was not by statute, but was what they said by common law, by decision, by the evolving practical situations. So powers of attorney were used at common law so that if something happened to me, I would be able to give somebody else the authority to deal with my property. That was the traditional issue. And of course, it would be in Ontario because property rights in Ontario are governed by provincial jurisdiction. And so what it is that when you set up a power of attorney, we would create these documents 40 years ago that would be like 35 pages. I mean, you could almost fall asleep reading them. And you'd say, well, why were they so extensive? Like, why were they that way? And that's because the law, the English common law decided by judges, was very skeptical. If I gave my power of attorney for property to Nick, I'll pick on Nick today in the studio. So I gave him my power of attorney. The courts were always worried, well, is Nick going to take all of Joe's money and run off to Las Vegas? I mean, you know, how are we going to control this guy? You know, what are we going to do? So the English common law was very, very worried, and probably rightly so, about the misuse of this power. Because, you know, if I want to go to Las Vegas and spend all my money, that's my right to do that. Or if I want to take all my money and give it to the Catholic Church, that's my entitlement. I can do that while I'm alive. But maybe Nick should not have that kind of authority. And so what they started doing was they started to say, no, whatever you want to give somebody the right to do has to be very specific. So over hundreds of years, there were cases that were established that said, the power of attorney can do this, the power of attorney can do that, and so on and so forth. So this became powers of attorney that went on for lots of pages so that we would limit the power of the power of attorney. On the other hand, there were people who would say, well, listen, if I trust Nick so much, if I trust the person that I give the power of attorney to so much, isn't it just okay to do that, and whoever could be affected by it could take them to court if they wanted to? So these were the competing legal ideas that were there that in the 80s were basically resolved in favor of the second approach. And I must tell you, it's the approach that has been followed not only in England, but in Hong Kong, which also has the common law, English traditions. So in most places in the world where the English common law was in a place and in full force and effect, there's things called the Powers of Attorney Act by different names. And what it did is it tried to simplify things. It took the second approach and said, well, listen, if Joe wants to give Nick the power of attorney to manage the property, let him do it in the power of attorney document. So you'll see that if you go to your lawyer and he presents you with this document and you say, what, you're charging me $300 for these two pieces of paper? I mean, you know, what's this all about? But, you know, it's like I used to joke one time, and they say, Mr. Martinello, it just cost $50 for you to sign your signature on this piece of paper. Absolutely. I said, it took me 7 years to be able to learn how to and be given the right to sign my name. So that's why you're paying $50. So they, I guess some people would think my signature's only worth 10 or 20. But anyways, That's what it's about. So the law changed by statute, and it said, and it made it more simple. And what it said was essentially, and that's the law in Ontario today, that the powers of attorney, that I give, Joe gives Nick the power of the attorney to do anything that I could have done myself, except make a will. Wow. You say, that's not possible, that the lawyers could have come up with something that simple and that clearly understood. But in fact, that's exactly what the law said. And it's actually a lot of common sense today, because if I, Joe, want to give Nick the power of attorney, but I only want him to do certain things. I want Nick to be able maybe just to sell my house, or maybe just to open up a bank account, or maybe whatever. It's up to me. I'm the person giving it. But if I think that Nick is a wonderful person and he's going to do everything in my best interest because he's been my friend, my best friend for 30 years, that's my entitlement to do that. So the law, the statute law that was created was actually, one could say, simple but effective, but not to do a will. And that is sort of a concession that was not permitted. You might say, why? Because believe it or not, going back to Roman law, there's an old saying that we learned in law school, and I'll use the Latin. I know some of you don't speak Latin anymore or understand it, but it's called delegatus non potest delegare. And what it means is something to whom something is delegated cannot be further delegated. In other words, if I gave Nick the entitlement to be my power of attorney, he can't turn around and give his buddy Frank that power of attorney that I gave him. And that's an old, old Latin legal concept that if I repose trust, this is the key, trust again, trust in Nick to act in my best interest, I don't allow him to go give it to third person that I may not know. So that is the thing that you have to understand. There's also other practical differences. I mentioned before about have estate planning tools and techniques for people who have businesses and they own shares and so on. So, for example, shares are property. So if I owned 100 shares let's say Suncor, for want of a better word, and Nick has my power of attorney, and for some reason I can't act, he can go and sell my shares and do whatever because he has that power of attorney. He has that property right to do that. He cannot make a will, but he can do that. And so, or even if they're shares of my own company, let's say, so he can take control. But he can't. But if I'm a director, he can't step of that company. He can't step and say, "Well, here, look, Joe made me his power of attorney, and I'm the director of this company, and therefore I'm going to make Frank the new director of this company." No, he can't. I can't do that because, again, delegatus non potest delegare, because that responsibility as a director of a company was given to me by the shareholders. And the shareholders nominate the directors, and the directors nominate the officers. So there are some practical aspects, but most power of attorney documents are limited in that context. And so it's important when talking with clients to try to have them appreciate what the purpose is for what they're doing. Because sometimes powers of attorney are just limited in time. Maybe I'm going to Italy for 6 months. And I want to sell this property that I've got or do something. So I'm going to give Nick the power of attorney to take care of it. He'll probably communicate with me. But I don't want to come back from Italy during my holiday to take care of the closing this transaction. So that's something that occurs very commonly where people are away or people are down south in Florida for 6 months, during the winter season. And they have things that go on. So these are the kinds of limitations that you deal with or that the client tells the lawyer when we're looking at the will, okay, what does this mean here? I mean, he can do anything. I want to impose limitations. Oh, I'm going on an around-the-world trip for next year. I'm going to take my sailboat around the world, but I want Nick to be able to deal with things. Okay, so we only make the power of attorney valid for 1 year. These are the kinds of limitations that can be placed on it. Other limitations that can be placed on it, some people say, you know what, I only want this power of attorney to be used if I'm not able to make my own decisions. Actually, it's in the power of attorney already. Some people like those limitations. Some people don't like those limitations. But it really, the power of attorney is designed to be used for property, is designed to be used when I can't do something. I'm under disability. I'm in a coma. I'm out of the country. I can't make my own decisions. And that being said, though, because it's a position of trust, we always tell our clients to probably give a copy to the person to whom you're giving this power of attorney to. So if they need to exercise it, they can do it. Don't keep it locked up in your safety deposit box that the bank won't give you access to, that if in times of need, will require a court order to open. So those are the issues. When is it going to be used? It's going to be time period. And if it's going to exclude certain things or not in terms of property. And that is under the Powers of Attorney Act. Now, we're drawing near the end of our time allocation for today. But in the next broadcast that I'm going to do, I'm going to start talking about powers of attorney for personal care, which is also a second power of attorney that was recently created in the historical time. The power of attorney for property has been around a lot longer. Why it was created, what's in it, what people look at. And then after we talk about powers of attorney, we're going to start talking about the nuts and bolts of a will and clauses in a will and why they exist. And you're going to unfortunately have to listen to me talk about the history of things because it all has historical base. and a development, and that's why things exist. And that's why when people talk about changing the laws or how things work, it's always in the context of how things were and whether they're working or not, or there are better ways to do things, just like the Power of Attorneys Act for property was reformed after a few hundred years in order to be as simple as, let me delegate to this person that which I could do subject to some minor exemptions. So on that note, I want to wish you all a good weekend. Hope you enjoyed our broadcast, and we'll see you next month to talk about, again, powers of attorney for personal care, and hopefully to start also analysis and discussions relating to what a will actually contains and why.
You have been listening to Ask the Lawyer, hosted by Joe Martinello. Here on Radio Maria Canada, a Catholic voice wherever you are.